Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Joined again today by Josh Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project. Top of the morning, Josh.
Top of the morning to you.
So we are not in the studio today. We're recording remotely just to be COVID safe. We're both healthy, but one of us, me, was exposed to COVID over the weekend. So we're trying to keep it reasonable here. We spend most of the time, in particular, you know, in a very relatively narrow sense, I think, in the last few sessions, looking closely at the internals of Texas politics, if you will. And look, there's a lot going on this week that we could call attention to, and a lot of this has happened, you know, fairly recently. Campaign finance reports are out for Texas races. Department of Justice report on Uvalde is being released, I believe, as we are recording this on Thursday at 11. That, you know, highly critical, not surprisingly, of the response. Calling all reds congressional vote for a resolution condemning the Biden administration's handling of the border, ongoing border negotiations in Congress. So there's there's plenty going on, and I've left a few things out probably stateside. But, you know, while I think some of these things are going to come up, I thought we should do today is in the wake of Iowa and just given the timing of where we are in the political calendar, I want to go with one of the big external factors that, you know, are in play in Texas elections, you know, mixture of the direct and the indirect, maybe, that we'll unpack. And that is, you know, the presence of Donald Trump in Texas. Now, before we get underway with that, I do want to point out a post that a couple of pieces actually that we posted at the Texas Politics Project website that rounds up data from the six polls that we conducted in 2023. The most recently posted piece looks at data in nine or so areas that provide context for the 2024 election, and the Trump discussion we're kind of set up to have today as part of that. And then we have another piece that drills down much further on kind of the interplay between Texans' judgments of what the legislature undertook in 2023, and they undertook it all year, and their expectations of how well the legislature did, how that kind of plays into primary politics, state politics, etc. Both of those pieces, if you go to texaspolitics.utexas.edu, you can follow the blog link, and they'll be, you know, near the top of that list, depending on when you go. So with that set up today, you know, with the election clearly underway, you know, we did think that it was a good time to take stock of one of the big external factors shaping the election, Donald Trump, and the election in Texas, and Trump's presence in the Texas political universe. Now, you know, as we've gone back and forth talking about this a little bit pre-production and chatting back and forth and looking at what we had, I mean, I think, you know, like almost anything to do with Donald Trump, unpacking this involves looking at things that are, you know, very, you know, kind of simple and maybe obvious and complex, and things that are a little more complex and maybe not so obvious. So, you know, on the heels of Trump's big win in Iowa, which, you know, despite all the coverage leading in, a whole topic unto itself, you know, I don't think anybody was particularly surprised by that outcome. You know, certainly, I don't think you were, Josh, and you know, not that Iowa and Texas are the same, but, you know, I think we can start by looking at the early presidential primary trial ballot numbers in our December poll, which look not unlike the Iowa outcome, not unlike what we're seeing nationally. The only thing really that looks particularly different is New Hampshire, the New Hampshire polling, and we can talk about that. And I would still argue that New Hampshire polling is different in degree, but, you know, we'll see how that shakes out. I mean, yeah. I think that's all about right. I mean, I don't think there's anything too controversial in that.
Yeah, I mean, the New Hampshire issue just has to do with the curious nature of their primary process and, you know, the added difficulty of gaming out what the primary electorate there is actually going to look like, in particular, how, you know, what share of that electorate is actually going to be made up of non-Republicans. And I think if you go look at the polling among Republicans there, you're going to see pretty similar numbers there to what you saw in Iowa and what you're seeing nationally and what you're seeing in the Texas poll. So what we saw, you know, going back to our December poll conducted at the end of last year, was we saw 65% of, you know, potential Republican primary voters say that they would be supporting Trump in the 2024 Texas primary election, similar to what we're seeing both in polling and in reality. You know, it leads to him trouncing his nearest opponent, which at the time of our polling was Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. He received the support of only 12% of voters in that December survey. I think some more recent polling that may have come out even today shows Trump with similar levels of support, although it looks like Haley and DeSantis flip in that polling, but they're still sitting right at about, I think Haley's at about 11% there and Trump's at about 69. So again, all within the same ballpark here. You know, I think what's notable, you know, I mean, about that in some ways, and this is, so we sort of talk about this and we say it's notable and it's not, you know, sometimes we joke, you know, if 90% of people think something, then there's no group that where it's like, well, they only 20% right think this.
Yeah. You know, and when you're in the high 60s, that's pretty, still pretty close.
Yeah.
Mid to high, you know, 60s.
Yeah,
math same dynamic is at work. Yeah,
right. Math kind of works that way. So, you know, with that strong showing overall, you know, Trump is dominating most of the groups that we think are going to make up the primary electorate in Texas. So 80% of those who identify strong Republicans say they're going to support Trump. 69% who identify as conservative. Amongst those who identify as extremely conservative, it goes up to 76%. You know, another sort of core group in the GOP constituency, especially here, sort of biblical literalists. Yes, very religious voters, 71% of those say that they're going to be supporting Trump. But even when we look at sort of the groups that we think of as maybe being potential sources of exposure for Trump or weaknesses in the coalition, even here, he's still running, you know, fairly, if not very strong, right? So 56% of moderates, which, you know, is not a huge share of the GOP coalition, but still a majority of the moderates in the GOP right coalition say that they are going to be supporting Trump.
And we should say that the universe here was, we asked people what primary election, you know, if they were going to vote in the Republican
right
primary.
Right. So this isn't all moderates, but the idea is if you're a moderate who plans to participate in the Republican primary, you know, odds are that you're right not going there to take Trump out. Actually, odds are just barely that you're there to support him. Right.
Right.
When we look at the less strongly attached Republicans, those who initially identify as independents, and then but then when pushed say, well, I'm a Republican, who will be voting the primary again, half say they'll be voting for Trump. You know, even we look at kind of the groups we think of as maybe up for grabs, 63% of suburban Republican primary voters say that they're going to be supporting Trump.
Yeah, I think, you know, as we were digging up some of the notes for this, you know, I think that's a number to come back to.
Yeah.
You know, it's one to put in the pocket in terms of talking about, you know, the battle in the suburbs. Now, look, you know, if you're a Democrat, you could say, yeah, well, it's not like a rural area where it's, you know, yeah, whatever, 85 or 90.
But it speaks
that's
to
a big number.
But it speaks to what, you know, like something you kind of put a pin in up a little bit above, which is, you know, the press's coverage of this. You know, I don't know if it's fair or unfair, and I'm not, you know, I'm not crapping on the press on this one. It kind of is what it is. You have to cover Iowa. It is what it is. It's a news event, regardless yeah of whether the outcome is pretty predictable or not. You know, it's notable that this was probably the least interesting Iowa, at least in my lifetime, in terms of just, you know, like actually kind of looking at it and sort yeah of thinking about the result, even over the trajectory of how people interpret Iowa results as being either super important or not important at all or anywhere in between.
Yeah, for comparison, you know, Ted Cruz narrowly won last time.
Yeah, President. Oh, right. Now, so that's the thing. I mean, it is what it is, but nonetheless,
I should correct myself. Not last time, in 2016.
Right, in 2016. And so, well, the last time there was a competitive
right
Iowa caucus for Republicans.
We can yeah say. I was right-ish.
You're right. Right enough. You know, post truth world we live in. But the idea is the same thing. Is that I think there's this there is a tendency to say, okay, well, you know, you want to make more out of this. So you say, well, yeah, Haley, you know, so Trump's strong, but like maybe he's not so strong with these people, or who is Haley strong with, or who is DeSantis strong with? And you start to try to look in these numbers for potential sources of weakness, you know, whether out of desire, curiosity, whatever. And the point is that like, if you've been doing this, you would say, boy, doesn't really exist. And I mean, and I think, you know, part of the polling, you know, that kind of, I think, elucidates some of this is that none of this should be really surprising given sort of the longer term trajectory of views of Trump, you know, both nationally, but also in Texas. And we look among Texas Republicans, you know, the most recent poll found 80% saying that they had a favorable view of Donald Trump. You know, this is, I would say, very much on the trend line, you know, for Trump post-presidency. And so there's no situation, we looked at this, you know, after January 6th, in the aftermath, throughout the legal drama and the trouble, which they are very aware of, people are hearing a lot about, views of Trump have not shifted within the Republican electorate. And so really, in some ways, you know, he's underperforming his favorability a little bit, which actually shows, you know, he has room to grow. It's not as though, you know, it's not as though the 63% is necessarily a ceiling for him, nor does it mean that, you know, the other 38% of Republican, you know, primary voters aren't going to show up for Trump come November because there's overwhelmingly positive views of him. Now, look, that doesn't mean he doesn't remain, you know, insanely divisive along party lines here as elsewhere. But, you know, overall, sort of sitting there, you know, 46, 45, fave, unfave with the Texas electorate overall, but with 80% of Republicans holding a favorable view of him, pretty comfortable place to be.
Yeah, and remember that, you know, in terms of the way this race is looking right now, if you flip that and look at Joe Biden's favorabilities among Republicans, he's 77% very unfavorable.
Right.
Now, I think that, you know, I mean, look, in Texas, you know, that's not, you know, that is what it is. I mean, I think it does raise the question, and this kind of jumps ahead a little bit, but, you know, about just how much minor bits of attrition in Trump's numbers, you know, should that happen? And, you know, we've seen that in a couple of windows where, you know, I was looking at the trend in those favorability ratings. You know, the where he was in December is about right, you know, as you say, implied, is like right in the middle of where he's been. It's kind of, I'll bet the average is pretty close to 80.
Yeah.
Because I think he's moved between about, you know, low to mid 70s and low to mid 80s.
Well, that's the point. He's never dropped.
I think his high point was maybe 85 at some point.
Yeah, and he's never dropped below 71 or 72 or anything like that.
Right. So, you know, he's, you know, I guess that, you know, that does, in terms of thinking about the national election before we get to thinking about what it means internally in Texas, this question is out there, is that, you know, small bits of attrition could hurt him. Mm-hmm. In competitive states, in the six or seven, or maybe it's eight, real competitive states that people are swing states that people are looking at. But sorted out, you know, his, you know, the Trump-Biden dynamic and negative partisanship and all these, you know, a lot of the usual suspects. You know, I mean, I think it's a, you know, as we were going back and forth in chat, I think it's a super open question. It's hard to imagine that Trump is not somewhat vulnerable, given all the jeopardy he's in legally, to minor fluctuations, you know, minor attrition, you know, that small attrition in these competitive states could tell the tale.
Yeah, and I think it's true for Biden also. I mean,
that's the other shoe.
I mean,
right?
This is a weird election, you know, blah, 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 for a lot of reasons. And I think, you know, there's the obvious reasons it's kind of a weird election, having to do with, you know, sort of Trump's, you know, whatever you want to call it, norm busting, you know, Biden's age. I mean, whatever. Those things all play. I mean, we're still, I think one thing that I think we're kind of failing to appreciate, I'm just going to say this right now, but like, we're still coming out of the pandemic. Like, that sort of like sounds crazy, but it's not, because we're still dealing with the economic consequences of it, and even a lot of the social cultural consequences of it. And so we're still in a strange place. Having said that, I mean, when I said that it's weird, I think it's weird in sort of a different way, which is, you know, normally, you know, we think about these elections in terms of like, you know, persuasion versus mobilization is like a classic kind of concept to kind of frame how you think about it. Right. Often we think about the mobilization of partisans, and in some ways, you know, in the inverse, we are talking about the mobilization of base partisans. You know, how, you know, is Biden going to do well enough with Black Democrats? Is Trump going to do, you know, well enough with suburban Republicans, and so on and so forth? But in some ways, it's almost like that's not really what we're talking about here. We're really talking about attrition. It's like, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, it's not persuasion. Yeah. It's not mobilization. It's questions of attrition. It's, you know, can Biden shore up, you know, his progressive base after, you know, issues going on with, you know, the Israel-Gaza conflict, for example, and issues going on with the border.
Yeah, if they make a deal. I mean, they clearly badly want to make a deal on immigration, and we'll come to that. But
right.
that is not the favored move of the progressive right. wing of the party.
Yeah. And so, you know, Biden in some ways is trying to figure out, you know, how he can manage, you know, his own attrition issues. And Trump, in some ways, you know, has attrition issues that are, you know, I don't think anybody's trying to manage, and if anything, are being papered over a lot, which is maybe why we talk about it more. But in some ways, I mean, the math is almost, I mean, it's sort of, you know, we talk about this sometimes, like social science math is tricky, because really, like, the question isn't, you know, is Biden going to have, you know, 85 or 90% of African Americans voting for him? I mean, there's that sort of question, but it's almost like, you know, is he going to lose 0% of core, you know, Democratic, let's say, you know, voters under 30, or is he going to lose 5%? And so we're kind of looking at these small numbers and the collection of them, I think, in some ways across the electorate. And look, right now it's impossible. You can't know, because these are all estimates of subgroups a year out. I know yeah. that after the election, it'll be really easy for people to look back and say, this is what happened yeah. here, right? Sure. I mean, we can't do that yet.
And how wrong all the polls were.
And how wrong all the polls were that we're going to use to analyze what happened. Don't ask me. But I do think that this is sort of an interesting kind of unique moment where you're both looking at both candidates in some sort of ways and saying, okay, so like, what if Trump loses, you know, what if Trump underperforms by 4% with Republican women this yeah. time around compared to last time? You know, that alone might not make a big difference. But when you think about the competitiveness of these handful of battleground states, especially, this right. is where it makes a difference. You know, when you're talking about differences of, you know, a couple thousand votes here or a couple hundred votes here or there, then all of a sudden, you know, a turnout rate, you know, 2 points below the target kind of makes a big difference. But it's hard to tell a story like that in the lead right. up to the election.
Well, you know,
as
I
opposed
think,
to look at these big, large groups of voters and say, oh, this is where evangelical Republicans came around for Trump. You know, you're talking about the fat part of the distribution. You're not talking about the small share who's like, you know, maybe not for me.
Right. Well, and I think just to add a small, you know, data point on that, you know, since we talked about the Trump trend, I mean, you know, the Biden trend in job approval in Texas, you know, is not great. I mean, he's, you know, he's been at basically 75 in our last three polls approval among Democrats. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, on the low end of where he's been, right? I mean, not, you know, in no way should anybody look at these numbers and say, oh, Biden's support in among Texas Democrats has collapsed. It is not saying that. But, you know, if you basically take out the first, say, 6 months, the first four yeah. polls that we did between February and June of 2021, which was, you know, pandemic response, early period Biden honeymoon, all these things, where his approval among Democrats and, you know, lingering euphoria over the fact that Trump was gone among Democrats, mm-hmm. you know, his job approval is, you know, 89, 87, 88, 88 in those four polls.
Yeah.
You know, he hasn't been above 80 since June of 2021, though, at or above 80. And he's been, well, that's not true. I guess he had a little burst in late 22, early 23 after the election. But he's been in the mid-70s mostly.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's sort of, you know, and I don't know whether this is true or not, I mean, in terms of this instance of it, but like this is also a pattern that like we've become pretty used to, right? Yeah. I mean, both in the main in the sense of the honeymoon period and its eventual wearing off, but also right. but also even in the internals of that, like, I mean, we're sort of looking at just approval overall. Ultimately, governing is hard. We've said this multiple times. You ultimately have to make decisions, you know, as I think I love, you know, Obama's take on this. Like, nobody brings like a set of good decisions to the president to decide, you know, what great thing he gets yeah. to do. It's usually the worst decisions. And so whether you're Trump, whether you're Obama, whether you're Biden, whether you're Bush, you end up making a lot of decisions that are going to make people unhappy, including people unhappy in your party. And so when we break those numbers down, what you tend to find is that like Democratic distaste or dislike or unfavorable ratings for Trump are through the roof and they're extreme. You know, so most Democrats hold very unfavorable views of Trump. Ask, you know, whether they have a favorable view of Biden or whether they approve of how he's doing. They, you know, the positive views generally split between the most favorable and then the next most favorable category because, again, governing is challenging, yeah. Right? And so I think, you know, we're at a point where there is a lot of this being sort of, you know, drummed up in part of the lead up to sort of the campaign year and campaign coverage to say, oh my God, look how weak Biden is. And I think there's some truth to that for sure. And a lot of that has to do with sort of these other macro, you know, external yeah. factors as well. But also it's just like, this is the pattern. This is what happens. Yeah. And this is what happens before you get into a campaign where all of a sudden, you know, those Democrats who may be like, well, you know, I don't know if Biden's taking on inflation strongly enough. And you say, well, you're going to vote for Trump?
Yeah.
No chance. So let's just, right. you know, we got, you know, there's a certain period that needs to happen where this sort of stuff needs to, you know, congeal in some kind of way that really just hasn't yet. And anything I think that's sort of going too far down this line is like looking at data in January is like, you know, it's useful and it's instructive. And I think trend data is obviously a lot more instructive because it can tell us what's sort of real versus ephemeral, what's durable in these attitudes. However, we still have a little ways to go here.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as we know, the patterns related to partisan political attitudes and how partisanship affects voting behavior have yet to set in.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
We're in the primary season. In fact, we're in the opposite part. We're at the place where divisions are most likely and doubts are most likely to express themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that said, in terms of where Trump stands, I was interested to see in the Iowa exit polls, mm-hmm. and I was looking at the Washington Post, the ones the Washington Post posted, and I think there's a couple of different variances. But nonetheless, you know, the exit polls show evidence of very similar patterns that we're seeing in Texas in terms of what we might think of as some of the Trump offsets or qualifications. And that is, you know, kind of widespread indifference to Trump's legal issues. I mean, widespread awareness of them, matched by widespread indifference and the continuing rejection of the legitimacy of the 2020 presidential election.
Yeah, right. I mean, our October 23 poll, when we last asked about this, found, you know, about 2/3 of Republican voters disagreeing with the proposition that protesters who entered the U.S. Capitol on January 6th were trying to overturn the election. 62%, same amount, said that, you know, Joe Biden was not legitimately elected in 2020. And then, you know, kind of going to the aftermath, or at least partial aftermath, you know, asked in sort of August polling of last year about four different sets of criminal charges that Trump is facing, at least 70% of GOP voters, and really much closer to 80 or 85%, viewed each of those charges as politically motivated.
Right. What we mean by that is we polled on in that poll, we broke out different right. legal problems to see if there was much variance. And there's a little bit, but not...
Not much.
not enough to really, you know, make a difference. I mean, it was interesting. I think
Well, we wanted to make sure. I mean, these are the sort of questions pollsters discuss all the time. It's sort of, you know, do we just want to take a blanket approach to sort of the criminal issue that puts in quotes the criminal, criminal investigations Donald Trump is facing? But honestly, they're different, right? And so we do want to add, and they're not only are they different, but we know from the polling that people are hearing a lot about them. So it's actually worthwhile to ask about the campaign finance violations versus the document issues versus the overturning of the election. Those are right. different sets of issues.
Yeah. And, you know, the big takeaway there, like, you know, was that obviously it didn't make much of a difference in Iowa.
No.
And, you know, it doesn't look like it's making much of a difference here. And I think, you know, that carries over then into, you know, how we see Trump as a figure in Texas politics, and I both in terms of the election, but also in terms of the general kind of attitudinal orientation and the, for lack of a better term, you know, the mood of Texas Republicans vis-a-vis these kinds of issues, because I think, you know, we've dined out a lot, or we've kind of staked out a position in the podcast and in writing that, you know, Ken Paxton hoped to benefit and to be seen as a Donald Trump-like figure, and that we're not seeing him elevated in that sense, mm-hmm. given his approval numbers. On the other hand, you know, it's hard for me not to feel like, you know, Donald Trump's long-term effort to undermine people's, you know, voters, in particular Republican voters' belief that the justice system and the criminal justice system work, are legitimate and can be trusted, almost certainly has helped Paxton among Republicans.
Yeah,
I don't have, you know, I mean, I can't point to anything that says aha on that, I don't think, other than what we've already laid out there. But I mean, I think every time, you know, Ken Paxton's, you know, loses some motion in court, yeah, or gets impeached, you know, it's, you know, I think it's pretty plausible to say that when he says, you know, the House is, you know, illegitimate, or the courts are crooked, or, you know, this is just a political vendetta by this judicial actor or that judicial actor, that the ground has not been pretty well plowed for that to be accepted by Republican voters.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, you know, there's like a fine,
I mean, I don't want to go too far with that.
No, no, no.
But I think it's right.
No, there's I agree with you, but I think there's
just because the alternate explanation is doesn't make any sense. The people would go, oh yeah, these things are totally different.
Yeah.
You see no evidence that that's happening.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's just a very tiny, fine distinction to make within that, which is to say, you know, to the extent that when Ken Paxton says, hey, the judicial system is biased against Republicans, conservatives, me, whatever it is, you know, the ground is fertile for those types of arguments, right? And so, you know, because Trump has made it so fertile for those types of arguments, it doesn't mean that people wholeheartedly, you know, agree with it. It doesn't mean that people necessarily wholeheartedly have like a strong, robust, built out sort of sense of why this is the case, but it sounds right. Familiar.
Right.
And in and of itself, that means if it sounds familiar, then it sounds plausible. And that sort of makes that work. Now, at the same time, right, you know, that sounding plausible and sort of, you know, making that an acceptable argument on the one hand doesn't translate so well to the other piece of sort of Trump's approach to this, which is to say that, you know, essentially support for his version of events, you know, his narrative becomes the litmus test for Republicans. It becomes the litmus test for Republican right. candidates in particular. And Paxton's ability to take sort of, you know, general distrust of institutions, systems, the legal system in general, and turn it into, you know, sort of the, you know, just really just a background set piece.
It doesn't automatically make him the champion of that.
No.
To the extent that you think of that as a cause, it doesn't right. make Paxton the automatic champion of that cause in the way that, you know, people, you know, a lot of Republicans do seem to have accepted Trump as the champion of that cause.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, you know, in Trump's case, it's really at the service of something else, which is, you know, him, you know,
period.
Just at the service of him, you know.
Yeah.
And whereas, you know, for Paxton, the idea that this is sort of, you know, it's a bank shot. We say, okay, well, we can't trust the system, so therefore what's going on to me is unfair. So therefore you should, it's like, and Trump is such a, I mean, you know, we're kind of jumping around in some of the discussion points here, but, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that Trump has done really well in some ways, we talk about this idea of repeated games, you know, often in this podcast, right. And it's another sort of game theory, you know, IR kind of concept, is the idea of a credible threat. Well, Trump is an incredibly credible actor when it comes to threatening and following through with Republican yeah. elected officials who don't toe his line, right? And so because of that, I mean, it doesn't matter whether you are a governor, a state senator, a state rep, a congressperson, you could be the county commissioner, you could, you know, use the old saw, you could be the GOP dog catcher, but none of those people are going to say, you know, maybe Trump should have told those protesters to like cool it
yeah.
earlier, you know, or, you know, maybe I would have not like handled classified documents that way. I mean, the lightest sort of even seeming passing glancing criticism is very likely to have Trump
respond with massive retaliation.
Yeah. And
we're talking about international
relations.
Yeah.
And that's a credible threat, and it's a repeated game, and they know this. And I mean, Paxton right now, I mean, going into these Republican primaries, I mean, a lot of the question in Texas is the extent to which, you know, he is going to be effective at weighing in on these primaries against Republicans who voted for his impeachment. And setting aside resource considerations only, let's just, you know, it's not as credible of a threat. I mean, it's already being presented.
Yeah.
That's already clear, regardless of what happens.
Right.
And so it's just a different thing. Right. But at the same time, now going back to the overarching piece of this, but Trump's, you know, persistence and consistency in being, you know, a credible threatening force means that he really does hold sway over sort of the policy and the actions of Republican elected officials here in Texas in a way that's really outsized and remarkable.
Yeah. And look, we were talking beforehand and you were making, you know, sort of making the case that, you know, there's lots of reasons that Republicans in their own self-interest might be concerned, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely.
And you're hearing this, you know, I mean, look, you heard this from, you know, but look, I mean, you know, just to jump to that, I mean, you know, you make the argument, but I mean, the argument has been made by some people. You know, one can say that it was the wrong vehicle if you're thinking about somebody like Chris Christie or Asa Hutchinson. But this is out there,
yeah.
Right? I mean, in terms of, you know, the list of things that might concern you, just in terms of, you know, strict political self-interest as a candidate.
Yeah, it's really striking at this moment in the sense that, you know, like the Democrats right now are just hemming and hawing about Biden like crazy. I mean, the number of articles in the New York Times about, you know, these internal discussions amongst, you know, Democratic, you know, important Democratic officials about the campaign strategy or not of Biden,
right.
Biden's age and Israel and the border and all these things.
Right up to Barack Obama. You know, I think this was news last week or the week before, you know, having a phone call, you know, having a, you know, a conversation with Joe Biden in which he voiced his concerns. You know?
Right. And yet, you know, there's, you know, I mean, outside of sort of the Chris Christie's of the world who've really been pushed, you know, really to the fringes, you know, of the GOP, you know, there doesn't really seem to be, at least apparently, very much concern among Republicans about Trump's candidacy, despite clear reasons for it. Now, again, part of this is because of what we talked about. I mean, there's a chokehold here. I mean, you can't really voice these things lest you be punished. But like, just to point it out loud, like, he's lost two national elections. I mean, this is, again, just you know, the popular vote in last two elections he was in, he lost. Also, you know, in terms of the last two elections he was part of besides 2016, lost a lot of seats, you know, didn't really maintain a majority very well. And then I think the thing that I would be most worried about, you know, I think among, you know, if you're thinking about like sort of what Republicans should be most worried about is he hasn't really done anything to expand his appeal since he left office. And if anything, he's done a lot to really insulate himself within some of the more fringe elements of his party that he was really kind of, you know, trying to keep something of an arm's length with, you know, sort of think about the Proud Boys comment and that kind of stuff. And you go from that to sort of embracing, you know, just clearly Nazi-like rhetoric with respect to America's blood and things like this. Like, this is not necessarily the rhetoric or the approach of someone who's looking to expand their appeal. I would be worried about that, you know, if I were a Republican voter, you know, going into 2024, those twin factors.
Right.
But it's sort of like, but because of, again, the stranglehold that Trump has, I mean, almost no one is willing to give voice to this consideration.
Well, the other interesting thing about Trump on that, too, is, you know, the one place where I would say, well, you know, he is showing a more conventional kind of move in that direction, and I think it's consistent with what he thinks, frankly, is the way he's trying to split the difference on abortion.
Well, like that, he's like, he's like every other Republican, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, but as the guy that's sending the most powerful signals. You know, it's been an interesting dynamic to watch that.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that also sort of raises this other kind of, you know, sort of broad sort of Trump, you know, Trump-related effect on the political system in Texas and elsewhere, which is sort of, you know, it does raise questions about sort of the strength of the party going forward. So one, you know, you think more just pragmatically, like what happens when Trump, you know, either exits the field, goes to jail, dies. It's not, I mean, I think one of the things that this Republican primary has made clear is it's not really easy to be Trump. Right. In the sense that I think there were other candidates who thought, well, I can be Trump, but without this bad part, or like I can talk like Trump. And I mean, so far, no one has really proven that.
Yeah. OK. It's not that easy to occupy the Trump space. Right.
It's not. Easy.
I mean, that's kind of the DeSantis story.
That is the DeSantis story, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it wasn't possible. So on the one hand, there's this question of, you know, what happens to the party when this really huge animating force is no longer the animating force. But then the thing that I also think about is, you know, someone politically science oriented is like, you know, and what do you, and I guess I don't know how to phrase this, but sort of, you know, what's the role of ideology and all that? And I raise that because you brought up the abortion issue as an interesting sort of piece of this. And, you know, and we've talked, you know, on this podcast a couple of times, and I think we've sort of pawed at it and we keep talking about how we might want to try to get at this question better. But I mean, I think, you know, pinning down the nature of ideology and what it means to be conservative in the Republican Party at this point in time is becoming increasingly difficult and complicated. And part of that complexity really, in a lot of ways, is traced back to Trump, right? Who's really made it, in a lot of ways, a party about him. Now, again, he definitely has a set of issues that are a big part of his appeal. So I'm not going to say it's, you know, devoid of, you know, policy desires and things like that.
Yeah.
And something, you know, like an ideology. But it's not the ideology, I think, that, you know, Republicans have sort of relied on, you know, in the last 20 or 30 years as sort of a touchstone from which to move from.
And, yeah. You know, I mean, you know, there's been a lot. Yeah. Been a lot of discussion of that. And I think, you know, we still, you know, Trump is so, you know, I mean, you know, there's such a personalism to Trump's appeal. Not that it's not, you know, in a fairly identifiable ideological space, mm-hmm. but that's not the heart of his appeal,
right?
Rhetorically, or, you know, however you want to, you know, whatever, you know, spaces you construct, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you know, Trump will call, you know, I mean, Trump will call names that are rude, call people names and insult them, and, you know. Mm-hmm. Try to hurt them using that kind of insult. I mean, you know, I mean, this was probably scripted for him by somebody in Texas, but, you know, for example, you know, when he referred to Dade Phelan as a rhino, right?
Right.
I mean, but Trump does not stand up very much, very frequently, other than, you know, in terms of, you know, a narrow casted argument and say, you know, I am the true conservative very often, or I am the person who will save conservatism. It's just not, he leaves that to other people to do, and he gives people the work to do. As you mentioned, abortion. I mean, you know, his splitting the difference on abortion is, you know, something along the lines of, you know, here I, you know, I gave you the court, the rest, I've done my bit.
Well, you know, and I mean, interesting, just thinking about now, I mean, you know, going back to the last, his last period, you know, in the presidency. I mean, you know, the idea was he had to add Mike Pence to the ticket to give him credibility with, you know, some of the most conservative voters, with evangelicals.
Right.
And I don't think there's any obviously Pence is not going to be VP.
Right.
But I don't think that's even like the tenor of the discussion at this point. I don't think.
Yeah. I don't know if you've seen it. I don't know if it's come out yet, but the Jonathan Martin from Politico has a thing about the, has a column that came out today, this morning, about the vice presidential race. And, you know, one of the things that struck me was, you know, I mean, I think that was contained in that article, this kind of like, you know, mm-hmm. Donald, you know, what, if there's anything you saw in the Iowa, also in the Iowa exit polls and in the overall results, it's that Donald Trump has made the sale to evangelicals. And
right.
there's a big New York Times piece on this, I think last week or the week before. But the other thing that was interesting about that is how similar the parsing out of, you know, different vice presidential candidates and the logic for the choice that Trump himself would make. And there's always, you know, it's a cottage industry in election years, you know, to talk about why vice presidents get picked and not picked or whatever. But it's really similar to things that we've been talking about. I mean, it really highlights some of the things that we've been talking about in Texas that are in one of the pieces we posted. And I, you know, we made reference to the Texas Monthly piece, you know, on, you know, the internal fights in the Republican Party, that, you know, ideology is operative, it's important, but there's a lot of other things going on. And there's a lot of other things going on in Trump's choice of a vice presidential candidate. Just like there are a lot of other things going on in looking at, you know, various conflicts and races that in Texas that we've talked about, you know, Trump is the great disruptor of that nationally. And I think that is having an effect in Texas. And I think when we think about that point you were making about Trump and the National Party, that is manifesting in Texas, but it's manifesting in conjunction with, you know, the dynamic that we've talked about a lot, which is that, you know, Republicans are basically left most of the time to hash things out among themselves.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's not, And so, you know, Trump just, you know, I think throws jet fuel on that dynamic in Texas. Mm-hmm. He's not even the main, he's not the main source of it here, I don't think. You can't really understand it without his presence and the what he's activated. But, you know, he's a factor in that, but it goes back to a point that we've made while Trump was president, or maybe even while he was still running, that, you know, the raw materials of what, you know, Trump himself and Trump's opponents and Democrats now call kind of the MAGA, you know, ideologic, the MAGA tendency in politics, all those raw materials were pretty active and already kind of in play in Texas before Trump even entered the stage. He catalyzed and mobilized that stuff and basically kind of stepped over Ted Cruz in adopting the most ideological and the most combative elements of that.
Yeah, and in doing so, I think, you know, to your point, there's a lot more going on in each of these elections. But what's interesting is that, you know, to the extent there's a lot more going on, it's still being framed in this kind of almost antiquated frame of like, well, who's the true conservative? Who's the rhino? Who's the crypto Democrat or whatever?
Yeah.
And in some ways, you know, we wrote about this and maybe we talked about this recently, you know, 10 years ago, like, I mean, that almost would have made sense. Right. You know, in the sense that you could look at the two main candidates in a Republican primary for, you know, a state house race, and you could see that you could look at the interest group alignment behind them, you know, and you'd have basically what's usually a very, you know, a solidly conservative, you know, across any classical kind of measures of conservative incumbent member being portrayed as anything but by someone challenging them from, you know, further on the right.
Right.
And at this point, you know, I mean, and that described, I would say, honestly, that described most competitive races in the primary. That was a pretty good shorthand. I mean, there's very occasionally there'd be like a member who left a seat and came back or whatever.
Or there's local dynamics that, like, you know, don't get picked up. Or
so-and-so. Yeah. So-and-so has had a long running dispute with, you know, the county commissioner.
Right.
Now that blah, blah, blah. Right. Sure. Politics, local, that stuff happens. But those were the edge cases. Whereas now, you know, when you say, okay, you know, this incumbent's being challenged by this challenger, and you say, well, Abbott's on one side, you know, Paxton's on the other, Trump is, you know, kind of like, you know, both of them are claiming that they're Trump's candidate.
Right.
And really, like, ultimately, we're talking about, you know, if you think about the output of the legislature in the last few sessions, extremely conservative members by any measure. It's not like these members were not voting for the most conservative policy measures. But all of a sudden, the term just has, you know, I wouldn't say the term necessary, I don't know. I don't know if I want to say it this way. I'll say it, and then I may also say it. Either the term has less meaning now, or it's just so difficult to discern.
Well, and one of the things we were writing, and I don't remember if I edited it out or not recently, I think the longer, you know, the more focused piece on the website from a few days ago, you know, I kept wanting to talk about the destabilization of the meaning of conservatism, you know, and what resonates as conservative. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, kind of conventional pieces to that, dare we say, you know, the shift in the Overton window in the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what we, you know, sort of have referred to in various kind of linguistic and conceptual constructions as, you know, the expansion of the realm of legitimate discourse in the Republican Party in a rightward direction.
Yeah.
Right. So I think, you know, and I'm kind of mindful of that because I think there are some of these races where, you know, the person being derided as a rhino in some of the extreme cases here, the challenge to say people like Briscoe Kane and Jared Patterson, you know, you got to really question whether by any, you know, if you could come up with any kind of objective measure, the people challenging them are particularly more conservative than those candidates. So those cases exist. But I do think that in some of these cases, I mean, you know, people that were candidates and that are now incumbents that were the most incumbent person in their prime, the most conservative by any kind of reasonable measure of whether it's ratings or voting records or pronouncements, you know, were arguably, you know, at the rightward edge of the spectrum in that race. They haven't moved, but to some degree, the window has moved a little.
Yeah.
You know, and in some ways, a lot. And that doesn't automatically mean that they're being challenged by somebody more conservative, but it does create whatever you want to call it, the cognitive space, the political imaginary, where, you know, a different way that I would put what you put, which I, without disagreeing with your characterization of those races, but what I would say is 10 years ago, in a lot of these races, we couldn't have really conceived of a candidate that would be viable at all that was more conservative than that those people that were staked out on what was then the far right end. Now we can.
Yeah. No, and, right? And I mean, and it could be as simple
and whether they are or not, that still provides grist for somebody saying, well, you know, this person is not conservative enough. When people are like, well, yeah, I guess we could, move into actually coming up with criminal penalties for women who get abortions.
Yeah, I mean, that's a
bad example because it's
I'll give some less hypothetical examples, and this kind of reach, to the point, right? Which is, it's like, well, yes, that's true, but did you vote to impeach Ken Paxton? Well, then maybe you're not a conservative. Did you vote against, the voucher, piece of the education? Well, then maybe you're not a conservative. But I mean, there's some other stuff that's kind of floating around out there that I can't help but think about, which is like, do you think that the state party should, put out a statement that says that we shouldn't associate with Nazis?
Right.
Now, that's an example of, the expansion of the discourse, right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
And I think that's sort of, I don't want to say that, race and demographic change shoot through all of this, but we've written a lot about that. So it's a big
factor. Oh, yeah, but it's crazy to not,
And it cuts through, I think, in a way that's not as I would say it's not as traditionally ideological as people tend to think. I'm sort of thinking back to, if you go and you read Milton Friedman talking about, sort of the conservative approach to sort of, racial integration and equality and things like that. Whether you agree with that kind of stuff or not, it was a part of the discourse.
Well, and that goes to the earlier point, right? That and in Texas, it was part of the discourse in it was very close to the surface in a lot of discussions.
Yeah, but the thing was, and I would say going back to this 10-year, it was much closer to the surface in a very different way 10 years ago, right? I mean, in some ways, you think about the Rick Perry, snafu, right? In saying, basically saying that if you don't care about, these dreamers, these kids go to college, you don't have a heart. And the idea that the fact that that sort of was a part of one of the death knells for him, at the time was kind of surprising, but it was evident why that would be the case going forward. Yeah. But the idea that you could imagine anyone in Texas staking out anything close to a similar position at this point, despite the fact that the state's demographics have continued the trend in the same direction, it is a remarkable shift in the tone, but it also speaks to the idea that, ideology is hard to peg down because it's not a left-right thing and you can kind of turn it depending on who's talking and whether they have the resources to make that message, I would say central.
Yeah. And I don't have it right in front of me. I would be interested, it would be actually, this is a good idea for something to kind of parse out, to pick a few of these things and go back and look at what some of these attitudes look like pre-Trump, the discrimination, how much of things, where have things changed and where were they just bubbling under and nobody was exploiting them? And that is, I think at the end of the day where, if we're going to talk about Trump's impact, Trump has, this has become a cliched point now, I'm afraid, but I think, Trump not, I think the cliched part is, Trump said things out loud that Republicans were maybe a little bit reticent to say out loud, even in primaries, particularly around the kind of issues you're talking about. Cultural nationalism, race.
I mean, look, I just have to mention it because it's the most obvious sort of prominent recent example. I mean, the governor's comments about how, we're not shooting people crossing the border because the federal government would charge us with murder. Yeah. I mean, look, whether that was, a slip up, whether that was, let's say an ill-considered way to say it, whether that was what was truly in his heart, I don't know. I never will, right? But that's not the sort of comment that I think a politician, a statewide, politician, a governor would have ever considered saying, 10 years ago. But I'm not going to say it's acceptable, but I mean, the blowback, such as it is for someone like Abbott on this, is actually relatively minimal. Not only because
it was maybe a news cycle.
It was a news cycle,
and I'm not even sure that ultimately it's even fair to say he suffered any blowback. He got a little bit of negative coverage, that got even some national play. I agree. That is a great example of the degree to which you know, Trump basically was able to liberate things that were there and gave people permission, you know. And again, I would go back to my earlier point, and I think that is, you know, it's been a multiplier in Texas in terms of the degree to which, you know, those streams of thought and those attitudes have been around for a long time, right? And have been, you know, ever present in conservative politics in the state. But they've gotten a boost from Trump. And I think that goes, you know, to, you know, as we're getting close to the 50-minute mark here. I mean, I think that one of the things then, you know, to kind of think about with that is that, you know, to your question of, well, you know, where's the Republican Party going to be if Trump is convicted and, you know, I don't think this is going to happen, but he's, you know, if he's convicted and the bottom drops out of his support, and I'm not convinced that that would be the outcome, or, you know, he loses enough support that he then loses and he's maybe at least politically discredited among elites, you know, where does that leave the party? I don't look now and see where the energy would be in the base to move the party, to edge the party back toward the center. And I don't mean to the center, but just in that direction. You know,
I mean,
you know, we may find out in some other work we're doing. I mean, you know, maybe some of the people that have just been hunkering down and taking the long view and waiting for the fever to pass will go, well, you know, this took longer than I had hoped, but now I'll poke my head above the hedges. But I don't know that there's enough of the rubber band snapping back to enable that kind of behavior. And I don't look around the Republican Party and see a lot of good candidates for leading it, at least at this point. Now, they're all laying low, so why would I? But
yeah, I mean, the only thing I would put as a potential sort of counterpoint on that, I mean, I don't disagree with it in the main, would just be to point out that, you know, in the last election cycle that Trump was on the ballot in Texas, a lot of candidates outperformed him.
Yeah.
And a lot of candidates, especially in the most populous areas of the state, outperformed him. Now, this is obviously is a reflection of both, you know, Republican voters, but also some independents, maybe some Democrats in some of these areas. And so, I mean, there is evidence that, you know, I mean, look, I mean, how could John, I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about John Cornyn and Republican politics and say the fact that, you know, he sort of has this, you know, kind of middling position with Texas Republicans. And yet he outperformed Trump, you know, in a number of places, you know, on that ballot with a very different style of politics. So now, look, do I think John Cornyn is the vehicle for, you know, the post-Trump Republican era? I will say no. But I do.
But look,
think
he could be, you know, he could be Senate Majority Leader.
He could be Senate Majority Leader.
I don't think he's the leading. But you know, he's a contender.
There's a lot of things that have to happen between now and then. But I do think that, you know, if someone wants to say, well, is there evidence, you know, for some desire for I'll just put it like a more traditional GOP brand than the one that, you know, Republicans that has been dominated by Trump, you know, in the last, 8 years. You know, it's possible, right? But the other thing is, you know, as we talk about all the time is, you know, I think most elected officials can't see past their nose because there's no reason to. And so really what it comes down to is what matters right now in this election cycle. And so long as Trump remains the force that he remains, you know, it puts, I think it puts most Republican elected officials in a somewhat difficult position if the question is, well, what's the Republican Party going to look like next?
Well, it makes it hard to judge because, you know, I mean, it's, you know, we talked again about the political imagination earlier. It's really hard to imagine, like, what the actual dynamics are if there's a vacuum where Trump was. I mean, some Trump-like people obviously try to fill it. But it's part of, you know, to put your, you know, to touch on your point about the time horizons of most elected officials and put it slightly different. I mean, you know, there are a lot of people that, I mean, and I know this from talking to some, having conversations with some Republican officials that are pretty clearly just, you know, completely instrumental about this. Mm-hmm. You know, people that, you know, very loudly support Trump, but then besides going, so I wonder when this is going to be over and I can do something else.
Yeah.
You know, well, and there's still the question of what that something else is. But I think, you know, to your point, that sentiment is out there. But I guess, you know, in a more precise way, I wonder, so if Trump is gone, what is the lag you know, if the base is going to shift direction and orientation, mm-hmm. you know, to some degree, that will be led by elites. To some degree, it will just be the mysteries of, you know, mm-hmm. how people interpret the world and how, what their politics look like. You know, what does the lag look like if that yeah. is going to happen? And I think the lag is probably pretty significant and creates a lot of opportunity for entrepreneurs to try to fill that Trumpish space.
Yeah, and I'll just put just one piece of meat on that. The lag is going to be significant because the primary dynamic here, the primary elections in Texas, are still going to be low turnout affairs where, you know, whoever yeah. is sort of the most activated in the party is still going to drive the process.
Right.
And so long as those are MAGA, I'm putting like quotes, MAGA Republicans, well, then that's going to be the tone of the candidates.
Well, that goes, yeah, I mean, it goes back to the point we made earlier, which is that, you know, those forces that are dominant and have become more powerful in the Republican Party as an organization mm-hmm. have been there for a long time and are pretty well entrenched and are not likely to shift significantly after this. Now, the outcomes of some of those fights could be different, but
Yeah, you don't think they're going to say, well, Trump's gone, he lost, you know, let's say he loses, and you're going to go, you know, this isn't working. We're gonna take our power and give it back to you guys and go home. Right. Here you go, Chamber of Commerce.
Or, you know, we're going to decide that all these things that we felt were important and we identify with, we're not going to identify with anymore. And I just don't see much chance of that. So, all right. With that, good chat.
That was fun.
I want to thank Josh for being here. I want to thank, as always, our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. Point you again to texaspolitics.utexas.edu, where you can find the data that we've talked about. If you're finding this podcast on one of the excellent podcast platforms that carry us, if you go to the website to where we embed the podcast, you'll find supplemental material, links we've mentioned, data we've mentioned. So thank you for listening. If you're in Texas, enjoy the break in the weather. And we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.